Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Lori Townsend of APRN. A federal study by the U.S. Maritime Administration says the Port of Anchorage expansion has serious design flaws, and legislators have asked voters to approve a $433 million bond project that has $50 million in the port for it. Paul, it seems like there's a tale of woe here that our friends at the port are getting a longer tale of woe.
They're turning, they really are making a mountain out of a bigger mountain. So we are treated now to asking voters to vote for a $50 million portion of a $430 million bond, $433 million bond, in which they can't tell the voters what it is they're voting for. To me, I mean, there you are. To make it worse.
And if you go to the voters' pamphlet, what do you get? Nothing, trust us.
A list. I think what you, the thing about this is really mystifying is that not only do we have the $50 million that we don't know where it's going, we have a study that they're going to brief the Assembly and the Geotechnical Advisory Commission on 3 days after the election. So anybody who knows anything is sworn to secrecy between now and then. So the public is supposed to just take this on faith. It'll go fine. Then we get a summary released on the study that we can't know about that says, well, you know, the design may be inappropriate, and it's not going to stand up to earthquakes, we don't think. And here we are. So now people are going to go to the polls and decide, yeah, I'm going to a port and a poke or not. I mean, that's what you're buying.
A port and a poke. Okay. Steve McDonald, what has Channel 2 discovered?
Well, what have we discovered? It's a mess. It truly is a mess. Whether or not this thing is going to be passed by voters, it's a good question. Most of the voters reside here in Anchorage. The vast majority of voters reside here in Anchorage. Whether they go to the polls and actually cast a ballot, that's another question. But I think that this bond proposal, this $433 million bond proposal, is crafted in a way that everybody across the state gets something. So if you're in Nome, and I haven't really seen the entire list, it's a pretty good lengthy list, but if you're in Nome and you're getting a library, you may say, oh, I'm going to vote yes because I'm getting a library. I don't really care too much about that port down there in Anchorage, so I'm going to overlook that. Now, the Anchorage people could get out there, or even in Matsu Valley, too, and just say, $50 million, there's a lot of question marks, I'm going to vote no, and offset all the other yes votes that occur across the state. But I think it'll pass just simply because there's a little something in this bond proposal for everybody across the state. But that still shouldn't keep people from asking a lot of questions about this project.
Steve, let's think about a couple things here with the vote. There are probably 30% of the voters who will vote against any bond proposition just on the basis of they don't like spending more money or they like voting no. And then there are probably, I don't know, 40% who want their roads improved,
right,
hope there'll be a new bridge. There's a new bridge in there, for a replacement bridge for Fairbanks. So, and there's no real campaign here. I mean, usually you'd expect the general contractors or somebody to come out in favor of it, maybe some civic group or environmentalists to be against it. But, I mean, this all seems to be taking place in a vacuum except episodic news coverage.
That's right. Yeah, and the only news coverage really has been, about the port. But I don't think Alaskans have ever met a bond proposal for transportation needs that they didn't like. They've always approved new roads, new bridges, things like that. So that may be what carries the day in all of this, that there's a bridge for Fairbanks. There's improvements to the Seward Highway. Alaskans have always wanted better roads and better bridges and better transportation. So I think that those are the kinds of things that are going to help this thing pass. But there has been very little debate on this. I go back to, I believe it would have been 2 Augusts ago. My brain's gone to guava when it comes to remembering things. There was another huge ballot proposition. I don't think it was not nearly as big as the $433 million, but in that proposition was money to build the new sports arena that's going up across the street from Channel 7 for UAA. Now, had that been on a loan on a bond proposal, probably wouldn't have passed. But it, again, it was like a Christmas tree for everybody across the state. There were new schools. There was a library. There were sewer improvement projects on that ballot, if I remember correctly. And it passed overwhelmingly. And that's what this one's designed to do as well, I think.
Paul, one thing. The Anchorage Daily News wrote an editorial today. This is Friday we're recording, which called for voters or asked voters or suggested voters should vote no. Kind of surprising the Daily News would say that. They came out of, you know, came to that conclusion. But how much influence can one editorial have in this context?
Well,
you're an old editorial writer.
Well, I'm not old.
Yes, you are.
Okay. Former.
Thank you.
Experienced.
The
veteran.
In Anchorage, I think it will have a pretty important impact. The Daily News is still the largest voice
in the
state.
It's the paper of record, yeah.
Right. How it'll fare outside in Fairbanks or in McGrath or in other places. I mean, this thing started out as six port projects, and it's kind of grown into this huge Christmas tree that everybody's got an ornament on. So the Daily News, I think it did the right thing, and I think it'll have a tremendous effect probably in this area, South Central Alaska.
Okay, let's move on. Hurricane Sandy does incalculable damage in the eastern United States, especially New Jersey. Lori, are there any lessons there for Alaskans to learn in looking at the photos and reading the coverage?
Well, I think we've already started learning those lessons. We've had a lot of storms in Alaska, savage storms on the Northwest coast last year, record-breaking snowfall last winter here in South Central, and then in September some really big wind storms caused a lot of damage and flooding. We don't know the cost estimates here yet, but it's in the millions. But on the East Coast, I think that, you know, we're looking at upwards of $30 to $50 billion. Katrina cost more than $100 billion. There's 92 deaths so far, probably more to be coming.
Right.
Still more than 3 million or almost 3 million people are still without power. So to me, the lesson is that regardless of your stand on climate change and how it's happening, it is happening. And these extreme weather events are predicted to become more common. You can't directly link one weather event to climate change, but as the planet temperature rises and the ocean sea levels rise, it's creating more severe storm impacts on coastlines. And so the lessons are that we have to be more prepared. It's going to be an increased burden financially for the federal government, for state governments, as these large storms have to be paid for. And I think that people need to be more prepared themselves. I heard this morning that some folks on Staten Island were outraged that it took 2 days for help to start arriving there. And given the level of devastation, I think that as these storms get more extreme and become less of an anomaly and more as kind of the new normal, then people need to be better prepared themselves to maybe have to hole up and bunker down for up to a week before help may arrive.
Or perhaps more. Paul, in retrospect, it's really not surprising that Governor Christie would buddy up with President Obama, is it? I mean, in the sense that Governor Parnell would have to do this. Wouldn't any governor faced with the kind of magnitude of bottomless amounts of money needed for your state?
Well, you know, Obama is the president of the United States. He does have control of agencies that, in fact, have direct effect on New Jersey. Christie is governor of a state that's been devastated, and he's out there working for his constituency, who are the people in New Jersey. So I think in these circumstances, all these guys put politics aside for a day or two anyway, and worked for the betterment of the people, the better the people.
And it's reciprocal politics at the same time.
I think
I'm helping you, and even if we don't say it, you're helping me.
That's exactly correct.
Michael, I would also say that the fact that in all three of the presidential debates, neither one of the candidates mentioned climate change or mitigation of the impacts of these more severe storms, and that's part of the problem here, is that we have to get that to become more of the dialogue because it's not going to go away. It's just
probably it will be, because 4 years from now, who knows what will be at the top of the list. Steve, Mitt Romney, at one point, he didn't say it directly, but suggested that FEMA might be privatized. This would seem like a pretty bad argument for that, whether in Alaska or New Jersey or anyplace else.
Well, we had an example of a private entity being responsible for an oil spill, Exxon, going back to '89. it got into a situation where it felt if we ventured into this area of cleanup, or I can't remember the specifics at all, but you, am I going to be held financially responsible for this? If we do this, is that part of our marching orders, are responsible for that? If we go over here and do this particular task, are we legally liable for that? There were just so many question marks. It brought cleanup for a while, maybe not to a standstill, but it certainly slowed the progress down quite a bit.
And didn't they eventually agree that the only way to deal with this was to federalize it?
Yeah, I think so. When you look at the power that the federal government has, including the state government, if we were to be hit by a massive earthquake right now here in Alaska, you know, the governor's got the power to call out the Alaska National Guard. Would a private entity have a chance to do that? If you've thought of that and gave them the
power. Although, in fairness to Romney, he did talk about returning it to the states.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how much money would you return to the states? Not $50 billion in appropriations.
Some of these things, it's going to be a multi-billion dollar cleanup for the folks there in New Jersey and New York and other parts of the Atlantic coastline. That's beyond the means of most states, if not all states, I think. I think you have to have that one centralized group, the government in this case, to marshal all the forces that need to be marshaled. Social service agencies like the Red Cross, National Guard units, you have to
and
have that.
Especially in the context of New Jersey now, where we have a certain amount of, maybe it's small or minor for the moment, civil unrest where people are fighting at truck stops over who gets what gasoline.
Right,
right. And that's something that you have to have somebody to take care of that.
Now, flip that over, and the government was in charge of the recovery in down in Louisiana when Katrina hit. That didn't go real well. That didn't go well at all. And you had...
Well, it seems like the president and every governor has convinced themselves, this is not going to happen to me.
Yeah,
I'm not going to be the next Katrina.
Yeah,
guy.
Yeah. Brownie, you did a good job.
Okay, once again, this is Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Lori Townsend. Lori, three subsistence fishermen in Bethel were found guilty of illegal fishing activities. They're misdemeanors. These convictions are the start of a number of trials that are going to be conducted in Southwest Alaska. They seem to have important symbolic elements to them, but they're also practical matters. Tell us about these trials.
Well, the closure started in June, on the Kuskokwim and Yukon and other rivers, and then the president, Myron Nanig of the Association of Village Council Presidents, asked the state for a disaster declaration for the poor king
returns. By closures, you mean the state of Alaska closed
yes.
fishing.
Yeah. Yes, excuse me. And a few days later, boats sent fishermen out anyway. Neposkiak, Akiak, and some other villages went fishing. Law enforcement, wildlife law enforcement were there. They seized nets. They cut some up. There were about 24 fishermen found guilty of, they weren't found guilty, not all 24. They were charged with alleged illegal fishing. And as you mentioned, three have had their trials and were found guilty and were charged. It was more of a violation than anything serious. The result was just a fine of under $500. And they're all being represented by the Northern Justice Project, just pro bono, because they had their charges reduced to citations, they couldn't get public defenders. So this organization took up their cause. Lisa Murkowski during AFN called the citations an embarrassment and said that they shouldn't have been fined. The National Congress of American Indians passed a resolution in support of the fishermen. They're looking for reversals or dismissing of the violations. We don't know what will happen. There's going to be more trials starting on November 13th. And I think that it kind of illustrates the tension between the state and the tribes, and that seems to be growing in some of these areas where there's a louder cry for more autonomy and more involvement by the tribes to regulate fishing and to have the ability to do what they've done for thousands of years and get the fish that they need in places where they can't easily go to a grocery store.
And state administrators say that we need to protect the resource to make sure that spawning fish return every year. So this would seem to argue for some kind of, let's all sit down at the table in some village, some public facility, and work out how we can work together and not have to go through this every year.
Well, part of the call from the AVCP, the Association of Village Council Presidents, is that they need to address the issue of bycatch, salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fisheries. And so they're trying to bring in some of those other elements that they don't have any control over and say that that's part of the reason that they're seeing these low returns. I think it's a combination of things. There's a lot going on out in the ocean these days. Again, it could be a climate change issue related to acidification and other things going on in the ocean that's impacting the salmon returns. And so it's not a problem that's going to go away, and I think it's just going to ramp up that tension between state and tribal governments.
On the other hand, if we had a couple of good years of good returns, it would certainly turn down the damper, wouldn't it?
For a couple of years, perhaps.
Okay, Paul, let's have the update on the legislative races. Tuesday is Election Day, and many people have already voted here in Alaska and many other states. Where are we with the legislative races?
Well, redistricting has had an impact in the Senate. There are two very hot races, one here in Anchorage, Bob Bell versus Hollis French, and Joe Pascvan and Pete Kelly in Fairbanks. Those two races are very close, very hot, very expensive, and there's been more mud thrown in those than people throw at a mud fence. It's an incredibly hot contest. That's just about it. I mean, beyond that, once you get into the other Senate races, it's mostly about the bipartisan working group, the coalition, the governor's tax policies, whether that coalition members will survive, most of them, whether tax policy will change, and Alaska's clear and equitable share oil tax gets cut. All of that's on the table this time. And those two particular races that I mentioned are really emblematic.
Well, I'm wondering here if we've seen a tremendous amount of advertising for and against the coalition.
Correct.
If you can really do much to change minds with those kind of arguments that we've seen, or if really this is a turnout election.
This is a turnout election. There's no doubt about it. There's very few, I think, undecideds, especially in those two races, but I think in other races as well. I mean, you have Make Alaska Competitive's not telling us how much it threw into it, but if you go up to the group that's Putting Alaskans First group, they've got $250,000 they've collected in a three-week period. So there's a lot of independent, the Supreme Court's decision on independent advertising's had a big role in this too. So you wind up with a lot of money in these races, and in these two particular races, there's tons of money, especially independent money.
Yeah, I heard that there's one poll that shows Kathy Geisel and Ron Devon at very close in that mm-hmm. South Anchorage Seward Senate race. On the other hand, I heard that in the last election, and Geisel won it going away. Pretty hard to tell. Although the district has changed, and it seemed to me Seward might be more friendly to a Democrat than what was there before.
Yeah, I think redistricting is really going to have an impact this time out. I really do.
Steve, tell us how the Alaska Public Offices Commission deal with the latest prominent complaint, which was here in Anchorage by a Republican, I'm not sure if activist is the right word, but
operative.
Certainly
operative.
People use that term as well. Against Hollis French.
Bernadette Wilson is the person who filed the complaint against Senator Hollis French, a Democrat running for re-election in West Anchorage. Ms. Wilson contends that Senator French collaborated with an independent campaign group, which is against APOC regulations. You're not allowed to do that. A group can come out in support of a certain candidate, but they can't strategize together. It has to be completely separate and independent of one another. So she says that there's been some collaboration going on. She filed this complaint against APOC or against French in front of APOC, asked APOC to hear the case prior to the election, which is, of course, next Tuesday, and APOC came out, voted unanimously, said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to wait until after the election to hear it, give it a proper amount of time and a good hearing rather than rush through.
And if I remember correctly, there was a suggestion, or the complainant wanted to suggest, that French's behavior could influence the outcome of the election or the conduct of the election, and they didn't find anything. APOC didn't. That
yeah, which should be a telling sign there, I think, about how they would rule if they were forced to do this or decided to do this now, prior to the election. But That's something that they're going to have to straighten out. But they felt that either not enough time, certainly not enough smoke there to delve into the issue right then and there.
Okay, thank you very much. Lori, you and I participated in the debate for the state, the congressional candidates, Congressman Don Young and challenger Sharon Cisna. What did we see from this? What did we hear from this, from those who only heard it? And it was all over the state.
Well, both of the candidates talked a lot about the Constitution and listening to voters, and both of them contend that they're the one best positioned to do that and have been doing that. Sharon Cisna has traveled around the state quite a bit. She made quite a bit of mention, quite a few mentions of that, that she's traveled around listening to voters. Don Young says, look, I've been doing this for 40 years, and people must think I'm doing okay because they keep sending me back.
Don presented himself as old reliable, I think it's fair to say.
There was some mention, as we were talking earlier, about severe weather systems and some talk about a question posed to them about whether FEMA should be exempt from some of the cuts, the sequestration and other cuts that are coming for the federal government. And one of the questions, or one of the answers that Don Young gave to that, is that a lot of this is caused by people themselves living too close to coastlines, and that we may have to know where to live and how to live and not live
in floodplains. This was very surprising, because it's rare that a politician will essentially come out and say, I think some of my constituents need to move.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Sharon Cisna said more extreme weather is coming our way, and if people aren't prepared or preparing to the degree that they should be, then that's something that's going to have to be addressed.
And Sharon Cisna still had trouble explaining how she's going to fly back and forth to Washington, D.C. without going on jet planes, because she's on her big airplanes, because she's unhappy with TSA.
She is unhappy with TSA, but she did say that, she mentioned that she would avoid just Alaska Airlines. So it did sound like she was willing to fly with other carriers. I wasn't quite sure how she was going to still get around the issue that she has with the transportation
security. And one thing this show did have is a conversation with Don Young on foreign policy, which I guess he surprised a number of people, including me, that he said he'd be willing to drop the atomic bomb on the Taliban if we thought that they'd stolen a weapon from, sort of came out of nowhere.
It was surprising, because he was very, very quick and definitive with that answer, that if it were confirmed that they had a bomb, that's what we would have to do very quickly. It was sort of a surprising fast reaction without, you know, some time to kind of contemplate it all. But Congressman Young's been doing this for a long time, and I suppose that comes with 40 years in a position where you're going to just...
Yeah, and he was arguing, he was very comfortable on the show and was arguing from a position of comfort. Steve, in a development that may bring big changes to Anchorage politics, the Anchorage Assembly is going to be reapportioned before next spring's election.
Yeah, 2010 census came up, showed that we are malapportioned, that the districts throughout the city are out of alignment. Populations shift, obviously, so there's not equal districts any longer. So there's three options that a consultant has come up with. Probably there's one option that would move the district lines around, but would keep the downtown district with just one assembly member. All the other districts have two assembly members, and that's probably the least impactful to the makeup of the assembly. The other two, however, would make East Anchorage a single assembly representative, and that would force two incumbents, Trombley and Honeyman, to face off against one another if they decided to do so. So that created some static from out in East Anchorage. The other one would make Midtown a smaller district, and that didn't seem to satisfy anybody at all. And then there were claims of, oh my gosh, politics coming into this process, and you knew that was going to come up. But Dick Traney, who's the Midtown Assemblyman right now, he says he's going to go for option one and introduce that before the assembly. So that may be the one that they consider.
And that's a little bit odd too, because if he has his way, it'll be I'm out of here.
Yeah, really, I'm going to the House of Representatives down in Juneau. You deal with it. But that's the one he seemed to like. And all three of the options got quite a bit of static. static from the people who it was presented to. So, it was, yeah.
Let's go to Paul Jenkins real quickly. Paul, social conservatives target Judge Sen Tan, who's up for retention November 6th. They don't think he's conservative enough, and they will set out to defeat him. What can they do in a week?
I'm not sure. He's mostly under attack for overruling parental consent, I think twice, maybe twice, and public funding, okaying public funding for low-income women. It's very seldom our sitting judges here unseated. I think it's only happened once or twice. I don't know what their odds are. They started late in the campaign. The Alaska Judicial Council is running ads and spending money in his defense. And so how it'll turn out is anybody's guess, but
I think we can stipulate here, based on experience, about 30% of the voters will always vote no on any judge any time. But there's a drop-off at the same time. There are fewer people who vote in this race than if you go down the ballot, then we'll vote for president.
That's correct.
And you really, it seems to me you need some kind of campaign or some kind of generation of energy.
I would think so. And they started very late, so I'm not sure that they have enough time to do anything.
Should we point out that the Judicial Council approved his, he said he should be retained. All judges should be retained.
And if you want to know more, go to the voters' pamphlet because it has all kinds of information, peace officers, other people evaluating the judges. We're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us once again on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.